A bank is being robbed. There are hostages. The robber is heavily armed, and you've got 10 minutes to negotiate the scenario. Go. Where do you start? What do you say? How do you save lives? Sound like a stressful situation? I know. Welcome to the life of Chris Voss, CEO of the Black Swan Group and former lead kidnapping negotiator for the FBI. In today's Expert Academy interview, we talk about how everyone can sharpen their negotiation skills, why most common knowledge regarding negotiation is complete nonsense, and why yes isn't always the answer that you're looking for. I learned more about negotiation in this single interview than the last three books on negotiation that I've read. So, if you are ready for a crash course in persuasion and negotiation, this interview is for you. Hello, everyone. Today, I am extremely excited to welcome Mr. Christopher Voss to the show. He is the founder and CEO of the Black Swan Group and the author of Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. He was the lead international kidnapping negotiator for the FBI, as well as the FBI's hostage negotiation representative. Chris was trained not only by the FBI, but Scotland Yard and Harvard Business School as well in how to negotiate, and he recently received the Attorney General's Award for Excellence in Law Enforcement. Chris currently teaches business negotiation at the University of Southern California, Georgetown University, and has guest lectured across the globe, and we are extremely excited that he's taken time out of his busy schedule to be with us here today. So thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thanks, Brandon. Thanks for having me on, man. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're glad you are. Now, I know that was a lot, but maybe in your own words, if you don't mind, can you tell everyone who you are and what you do?
Well, I'm a retired FBI hostage negotiator. What I'm doing is, my book, Never Split the Difference, we're bringing the emotional intelligence Jedi mind tricks of hostage negotiation to the business and personal negotiation. So how to do the same stuff that FBI agent hostage negotiators do in your day-to-day stuff, in your business deals, and buying a car, and negotiating with your landlord, all that fun stuff.
All the negotiation that us Western folks have no idea how to negotiate in terms of our culture differences.
Yeah, well, I don't know that there are any cultures. You know, some cultures have a reputation of haggling a lot. Being a haggler doesn't make you a negotiator.
That's a good point, and I think we might come back to that in just a little bit. But I want to start, because I know there is a real reason why, but our audience may not, as to why your company is named the Black Swan Group.
Well, black swans are little things that make all the difference in the world. The impact of the highly improbable, things that you're not expecting, that are just huge. And I like that as a metaphor for in hostage negotiation, because we would do the little things that would make all the difference in the world. Tiny little 2-millimeter changes, to borrow a Tony Robbins phrase. And so it's the slight little things, you know, tiny little adjustments that you can make in your negotiation style that has huge results. And then also the tiny little pieces of information that if you just get the other person to tell you, it's going to make a huge result.
I love it. Now, how did you get into the field of negotiation and studying and an FBI career?
You know, I could say, I could paraphrase Rocky Balboa, you know, because I can't sing or dance, which I can't. But, you know, I was in law enforcement, police officer, then an FBI agent, was in SWAT, was on a FBI SWAT team in Pittsburgh. And I had a recurring knee injury, so I wanted to stay in crisis response. And I knew we had hostage negotiators. You know, I thought, you know, how hard could that be? I could talk to terrorists. So I transferred over to hostage negotiation. That took some effort, took some negotiation, took a retool of my skill set, and it ended up being awesome. I mean, just better than SWAT ever was. And that's just for me. It's, you know, everybody has preferences. You know, communicating, establishing rapport with people, cutting deals that nobody else could cut. You know, there's something magic about using words to get a change in behavior. You know, I loved it when I was a police officer, be able to step into a middle of a situation that was bordering on being out of control when other police officers were threatening to crack somebody upside the head with a nightclub. You know, I could walk up and whisper in somebody's ear and get them to leave with no violence. I remember doing that a few times and just thinking, now that's cool. And so when I got into hostage negotiation, I mean, it ended up being the same kind of incredible highs using your words to change everything. And so that was kind of it.
That's awesome. Now, what's the training like for something? You know, is it they give you scenarios to work through, or is it principles and hypotheticals? How does someone start on their journey to become a negotiation master?
Well, you know, in general terms, like I started because I had no qualifications. I mean, it was pointed out to me that I was eminently unqualified to be a negotiator. No background, no psychology degrees, which now in hindsight, I think psychology degrees, and forgive me all you psychologists out there, but I think that's a handicap. We're much more into neuroscience today than we are into psychology. But I started on a crisis hotline. I mean, you want to learn how to listen between the lines and figure out what really makes people tick. And the other crazy thing about the hotline, when I first got there, I expected, you know, you get on the phone with somebody who's suicidal, you could be on for hours. Time limit of 20 minutes. You know, they told us on a hotline, if you're doing your job, you'll get done in 20 minutes or less, which shocked me.
That's not a lot of time.
You know, it's not. But in the overall theme, that one of my business school students who did a study and volunteered on a hotline also to see how it translated into business. And her study came up with the result that empathy saves time. Tactical empathy saves time. And that's how you can cut a deal with somebody who's suicidal, so to speak, in 20 minutes or less. I mean, it saves time. It's just a hack through the noise in most negotiations.
Now, I love that you brought up tactical empathy. It was one thing that I wanted to ask as well. And that's a bit different from what most people think of as empathy. Can you explain that for everyone?
Yeah, you know, most people think empathy is sympathy. Like, you know, if I get empathy for you, let me give you a hug. Why don't you come cry on my shoulder? You know, and that is not it. I mean, the real reason when I was with the FBI that we started to collaborate with Harvard was, you know, Harvard had the same definition we did, which is the mercenaries definition. And they even came out and said empathy is not about being nice, not at all. Mm-hmm. It's about being smart. What it is about being extremely smart. And so empathy is not sympathy. It's not agreement. It's not disagreement. If you can define it as a term of art, the same way Daniel Goleman defined cognitive empathy, which he said that's what sociopaths are best at, because they want to manipulate us. You know, they want something that works. If you can make a very narrow definition of it, then you can use it extremely effectively on anybody.
Gotcha. Now, I think a lot of negotiation or in a crisis situation, it's about asking, maybe not questions, but it's the quality of those words, and every single word matters, that most people just go on talking and talking and talking, but you have to be so strategic about what you say.
Well, you know, and there's kind of two things in there that are really important to get by a lot of people. First, the questions, and then the impact of the words. All right, so let's go with the questions first. We know that we need information. We think that in order to get information that we got to ask questions. That's only true a third of the time. A question might not be the best way because I need to provoke you in a good way into an unguarded response. Questions always put your guard up. You know you're being asked a question. An unguarded response increases the chance that you're going to give me really good information. For example, if I can get you to correct me, if I can get you to think that I'm wrong and you need to correct me, that's actually a very unguarded answer because you feel superior when you're correcting, which means your guard is down. You are also less likely to realize the vulnerability of what you're saying because you feel so good when you correct me, when you're telling me and show me how I'm wrong. So not only does it increase the chances that the information is honest, it's true, but also you're more likely to reveal something to me that you would not reveal otherwise when you're correcting me. Now, I'm not going to get you to correct me if I ask you a question. A good open-ended question makes you feel powerful, but you're not going to correct me. I'm going to want to say something that makes it think I believe something else, which means it's got to be a statement. And then you're going to go, no, that's not it. This is it. And you may really reveal some stuff to me that you would never would otherwise. So We need information. Questions aren't always the best way to get that information. Now, the other thing you mentioned, emotional impact of words. If I use the word you, it engages you subconsciously. If I use the word I, it makes me seem self-centered. That's the way it impacts you subconsciously. Neither one is good or bad. They're all driven by context. I need to use the word I when I'm setting a boundary or saying no. Great way for me to say no is, I'm sorry, I just can't do that. That's the proper use of the word I, and it's one of the best ways to say no. If I'm showing that I'm listening, which a lot of people have taught to show listening, they say, well, what I'm hearing is, that's a bad use of the word I because it's self-centering. And when I say, well, what I'm hearing indicates to you, I'm more interested in me than in you. You know, it's the old saying where a person says, you know, I've talked about me long enough. Maybe you should talk about me for a while. So you got to know what I does. And there's a good time and there's a bad time to use it. And if you don't know, then what you're doing is you're firing off a weapon. You don't know what you're hitting.
Gotcha. Now, when you're talking, whether it's questions or the words, in your mind, is there a difference between persuasion and negotiation, or are they intertwined in some way?
You know, persuasion is an aspect of negotiation. You know, what's the most effective form of persuasion? I could try to lead you into something with yes questions. Isn't it true that you'd like to make more money? Yeah. You know, that's so stupid, but people do it all the time. Or I could design my communication so that you feel it was revealed to you, that you figured it out yourself. Something as simple as it seems like you'd like to make some more money. That hits your brain a completely different way. It triggers some contemplation in your head. It's not a question. It's an inquiry. And you might say, it's not more money I want. It's more time. Bang, that was an unguarded response. Now I know that your commodity of choice at this point in time is time. Have you got all the money you need? Your retirement's funded, your house is fine, whatever, you know, but what you really want is more time. That's gonna dramatically change, help me adjust my quote value proposition by data from you, which I need to get it right.
And I think one thing that negotiators do better than average is listen actively. You're listening for those key things, and it's not just what the words that you're saying.
Well, and then let's take it a step farther. Let's have a book fall off my shelf behind me. the book and the Czech translation of the book just hit the ground. So to my Czech publisher, when you're watching this, you know, I'll put it back up and take another picture. All right, but let's get back to what you just said. Listen actively. Let's take it a step farther. Let's listen proactively. Now that we got some brain science, neuroscience behind everything, what do I listen proactively for? What I'm listening proactively for is where your sense of loss is. Now, your sense of loss is not the only driver for your behavior, but it's by far the biggest driver. There's an interesting stat out on sales that I was exposed to recently. It said 70% of buy decisions are made with people trying to avoid loss as opposed to accomplish gain. You know, old school, your father's sales approach, pitch the game, pitch the benefits. You can make deals that way, just not as many as you should. You make 30% of the deals you should be making. Let's make 70% of the deals instead. Focus on loss. Now, you know, I'm going to listen proactively for your emotional attachment to loss. And that's what takes it a step further.
Gotcha. Now, I know one of the things you've written about, and I think we're almost there as well, is not getting on the yes train by listening, using your words, and avoiding getting them to a yes.
The yes mode is so bad. I mean, maybe there was a point in time when it was a good idea. And, you know, I'm willing to concede that maybe it was a good idea. But it's so overdone. You know, the minute you ask me a yes-oriented question, you try to be respectful. Was with some pharmaceutical salespeople recently from Bayer. Bayer's phenomenal. the people at Bayer are not just saving lives, they're extending lives with what they're doing with their cancer drugs. You know, I'm dealing with these salespeople from Bayer that, you know, what they want to do is they want you to have one more Christmas with your family. You got cancer. Maybe we can't save your life yet. We'll give you one more Christmas with your family. That's what they're trying to do. So one of their salesmen is, they lay out the data to a doctor, and then he says, doctor, wouldn't you agree with what I've laid out? This is an appropriate treatment. Now, he's just trying to be respectful, but he's trying to get the doctor to say yes. And the last used car salesman that worked on the doctor tried to get him to say yes. You know, the last guy selling him timeshares on real estates in Florida that just got devastated by hurricanes. You know, that guy was trying to get the doctor to say yes. This guy's guard is up. You know, they've been pounded by so many of the hucksters out there on this yes mode stuff that there's an instinctive, automatic, negative response as soon as you try to get somebody to say yes. So stop it. All right, so okay, fine. I stop it. Now what do I do? You know, the insane thing is, it's insane. Get him to say no. I mean, so many people say, yeah, I don't want to talk to this guy. He's in the no mode. His automatic answer is no. I'm like, all right, change your questions. Change your questions so the no works for you, so it's not something to be overcome. I'll give you one that people are batting about 1,000 with. Have you given up on this project? The answer is, you know, the no serves you.
Right.
But see, the great thing about that is, although the answer is no, there's no commitment with it. If you say yes, you know somebody's got a hook in there that wants you to commit to something.
Mm-hmm.
This works across the board. I'm on the phone with the president of a network 2 weeks ago. I love being out here in Los Angeles because they say, all right, fine, this is the entertainment industry. Your hostage stuff is cute, but it won't work here. I get on the phone with the guy from the network and I said, look, just is this a bad idea to make no commitments whatsoever, but is this a bad idea to do this? And I wanted to bring another person into the deal. And the guy says, no, that's not a bad idea. As a matter of fact, here are the following things we could do. The crazy thing, once you trigger a no, since somebody has protected themselves, then feeling protected, they can actually think forward 2 or 3 more steps very quickly, which happens every time when we do it on the phone. And the guy says, yeah, not only is it not a bad idea, but we can do this, this, and this. So let's set it up. You know, in 10 seconds, I got before, which would have taken me 20 minutes of conversation. It's a hack. I hate, you know, a shortcut hack. You know what it is just really good emotional intelligence.
So restructuring your questions and listen for that loss aversion and getting them to say no can be much more helpful than the other way around.
Right. Just change your questions. I mean, it's one of the things we train people to do because it's a bad habit, and bad habits are hard to break, to get people to say yes. And with a little bit of a training, we can flip it around and we get people making deals right and left using it.
And I think I really like the fact that it is counterintuitive. So the fact you're really getting the answers that you want, you're avoiding the guard up, like you said, when everyone is using the same tactics, to go a different route lets you be a lot more successful in your negotiations.
Yeah, it's very counterintuitive. It's a different approach, you know, and there's a saying that the light bulb was not invented by the continuous improvement of the candle.
I like that. That's a good quote. Now, what are some of the most common negotiation mistakes that you see someone making?
A combination of two things. Being scared of silence and not willing to let the other side go first. Which you kind of got to shut up to let the other side go first.
Yeah.
But some people have described negotiation as the art of letting the other side have your way. Right? How do I do that? I got to get them talking. How do I get them talking? If they haven't spoken first, and believe me, the other side is dying to tell you what's on their mind. They're only holding back because they think you're going to attack. And they're tired of getting attacked. Or they think you're going to go into yes mode and try and trap them. You know, but use a label. Seems like you got something on your mind. Opens the floodgates. One of our clients said, labels open the floodgates of truth telling. Works across the board. Let the other side talk themselves into your deal. I got a tweet today, because this works everywhere. Geis is using a label in negotiations on his fantasy football team. Now, he wants a running back. He wants the other guy's running back. And all he just says to this guy, because he's thinking this guy's trying to swap out, he just says, seems like you're looking for a running back. Again, it's an observation, inquiry, but not a question per se. He said, I got the other side talking, ended up with a better deal than I ever would have asked for. Use the label to get the other guy talking. The art of letting the other side have your way. You got to let them talk themselves into your deal. You sit there, you listen, you nod, you know, and you encourage them. And then finally, when they come up with your deal, you go, wow, brilliant. Okay, you win. And then you have a deal.
Because they came up with it.
Exactly.
Yeah, you led them right where they want, where you wanted them to go. And once they came up with it, then they agree with it because it came in their mind from themselves.
Right. You know, and think of your sheepdog in a little bit here. You know, a sheepdog doesn't really lead its charges. It's the cattle, the sheep, the animals it's protecting, but it kind of cuts them off from where they shouldn't go. And then they end up where they're supposed to be. And they stay there because it was their idea, exactly as what you just said.
Gotcha. Now, when you're talking to someone and it's a negotiation with maybe someone you've never met before, where does that line go of building rapport versus getting to a negotiation, and how can you use that to your favor?
All right, now, a great question, because people think of it's I'm either building rapport or I'm negotiating. So as a hostage negotiator, we had to learn to do both simultaneously. Now, we think we got to build rapport because the negotiation process is going to be painful and it's going to hurt our rapport. So we're trying to build up, you know, positive karma points, because when we negotiate, it's going to cost us. As hostage negotiators, we said, that's dumb. There's got to be a better way. How do we build rapport and negotiate at the same time? That's why this saves time, because you don't have to spend time in small talk and going like, hey, no, you like pizza? I like pizza. You like baseball? I like baseball. Which has its use in some ways, but it's also ineffective. So we want to build rapport by genuinely dialing into the other side really quickly. And things move faster and you have less problems. It's, you know, I came to this insane realization the other day, because people are always asking about the difference between negotiating with terrorists and negotiating with business people. And one of the biggest differences I realized after all the business coaching, we've ramped it up in a past year and a half. We're coaching people through great deals. You know where there's the most yelling and name calling and threats?
In a business.
Business. Yeah. Like every single business person I know has got 5 or 6 stories about name calling and business negotiations, threats, people walking out of meetings, all this insane behavior, which some would say is childish, but in reality is just human behavior. I only know a couple of negotiators that ever got yelled at by bad guys, and the yelling didn't last. So are terrorists calmer than business people? Are terrorists more reasonable than business people? Well, what it is what we're doing on the other side of the table. We're dialing in really quick. And it's amazing how calm things get and productive things get when one side is listening really closely, actually listening in a tactical way for the emotional intelligence clues the other side's going to give off, but they don't know. You know, they're being triggered into unguarded responses. That helps us just get into the heart of things really fast.
Yeah, like you said, you're really listening and reading in between the lines to pick up on those those differences.
Yeah, and that's why it looks like Jedi mind tricks after a while.
Gotcha. Now, I know that you've written as well on the different personality types of negotiators, and could you break those down for us?
Yeah, it's principally, it's fight, flight, make friends. Assertive is the fight. Accommodating is make friends. Analytical is flight. An analyst sees fighting as a highly inefficient occupation, and is only going to fight if truly backed into a corner. Fight, flight, make friends. From the caveman days, you're walking down a jungle path, you see something startles you. Do I fight it? Do I run from it? Do I make friends with it? And it's in our wiring because it's the reptile brain, the amygdala, whatever phrase you want. We've all got that architecture. It doesn't matter what our gender is. Doesn't matter what our ethnicity is. Asians, Latins, Africans, Western Europeans.
And with the proper questions at the beginning, you're going to be able to tell what type is on the other side of the bargaining table as well.
You can pick it up pretty quickly. The assertives and the analysts will eventually come to look like accommodators because those two find out that the accommodators make more deals. And Stuart Diamond wrote a book on negotiation that we refer to a lot called Getting More. And Stuart Diamond is an analyst. Like, you want to look inside an analyst's brain, look at stuff that he wrote, because it gives you out. He starts out by saying, be dispassionate in negotiations. Only analysts say that. But he came up with a great stat when I was hearing him speak one time, and he said, you're 6 times more likely to make a deal with somebody you like. The accommodator, you like him. Now, the assertives and the analysts see the accommodators making all these deals, and they kind of go like, what's that guy doing I'm not doing? Smiling. So they come to look like, they're accommodators in disguise.
Gotcha. Now, when you're doing some of your hostage negotiation, I feel like that's a lot more verbal, or you said that your crisis hotline is on the phone. But where does body language come into play once you are in a face-to-face negotiation?
Body language, makes up the majority of the communication clues that you should look for. Depending upon whose data you're looking at least half of the information that you can get off of somebody is just going to come from their body language. So it gives you a lot more. It doesn't really matter what the percentage is. It's just the point is when is body language out of line with words? If they're out of line, it doesn't matter what the percentages are. They're out of line. So it gives you more data to read. It also gives you a little more data to project.
And I think that's one of the interesting things as we've been learning from so many body language experts. People want, you look for this particular movement or that particular. But as we've learned more, it's all about those baselines, variations, and it's not as easy as picking out, these are the three things to look for. It's got to be an in-the-moment analysis a bit more.
Well, here's a counterintuitive move. The baseline is truth-telling. And it's really the only real purpose, the missionary's purpose of small talk is to draw a baseline on what you look like when you're telling the truth. So we're the best hostage negotiators. It's the way that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 mastermind, was identified by two friends of mine in an interview of a separate terrorist on a CIA black site. And my buddies got together and they said, all right, let's lay the baseline down what this guy looks like when he's telling the truth. Then we show him the picture. And either he's gonna tell us the truth, or if he lies, it doesn't matter because it's not telling the truth. And that's how they identified Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Now, what does that mean? If I say to you, what'd you have for breakfast this morning? Where'd you come in from? Where do you live? I ask you questions you're going to tell the truth to, and I'm laying down a baseline. It's what a polygraph does. Now, you probably lie 5 different ways. But you only tell the truth one way. I don't need to memorize your 5 lie forms. I just need to get a handle on your one truth form. And then whenever you're out of it, you're lying. It saves a lot of time. It's actually what a polygraph does. That's why the polygrapher sits you down and says, what's your name? What day is it? Sorry about that. Let me get rid of that. You know, the polygrapher says, what day is it? What city are you in? What did you have for breakfast? They're laying down the baseline. Then, you know, whether you hold your breath, whether you look up and to the left, whether you look down and to the front, and you probably have three different life forms. I don't have to need to know all those. I just need to know the one truth form.
I like that. It makes it a lot easier than trying to memorize all these extra movements and ticks and twitches.
Look, exactly.
Look for the truth.
Yeah. And get a gut instinct for it. And then if you got a gut instinct, your gut instinct, I don't know, something about this feels wrong. Now what do? Well, actually, you go back to the tool that I was talking about before, the label, and you might say to somebody, you know, I heard what your answer is, but it feels like there's something in the back of your mind. I mean, that's a great way to give somebody an easy out when they've just deceived you. And more, because there is something in the back of their mind, that's why they deceived you. So go. Let's move past the idea that they might have deceived me, and let's go straight into what the problem probably actually is. And it saves a lot of time.
Right, and you're phrasing your questions and your inquiries in a way that they haven't necessarily prepared an answer to spit back out, which is giving you those unguarded answers.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Now, in your opinion, what would be some of the top skills, in addition to negotiation, I would say, what are some of the top skills that someone needs to succeed today?
Patience is a weapon. And in an era, in an age of overwhelming information, and overwhelming access to information, and incredible time pressures, the last thing we think is, we think patience is a handicap. We got to multitask. But patience is a weapon, you know, because then with a little bit of patience, you can begin to dial into the actual rhythm of things. So use patience and realize it's a proactive tool. And then also in keeping with that, multitasking might be the single worst thing you could do to yourself. My girlfriend gave me a great card the other day because I'd really focused on a process and it had paid off. And she says, it's better to whole ass one thing than half ass two things. which is a great way to say, like, look, you know, you're doing more than one thing. You're doing a lot of things. Forgive the term, but you're doing a lot of things half-assed, and you're just not going to have great outcomes.
I like it. Now, do you have a favorite negotiation that you got to be a part of, or?
Yeah. Wow. Because there's so many of them are so much fun. My director of operations, my son. Brandon, you know, and he's been negotiating with a hostage negotiator ever since he was two, so he's pretty good at it. He's coaching a guy through a job promotion negotiation the other day. And the guy's problem is he doesn't like to check with the authority. He just likes to do things, you know, to do an imitation of Heath Ledger and the Joker and Batman. I just do things. Well, this guy likes to do things. And so people above him think that, for all intents and purposes, he's a loose cannon. They're afraid to promote him. So my son coaches him in the promotion interviews to say, you know what, I'm a loose cannon. Just lay it out there. Not deny it, but call it out. You know, I'm sure I seem like a loose cannon. I'm always coming off like a loose cannon. And so what they did, because they couldn't fix this problem of him not reporting to his immediate boss, they just promoted him two levels instead, so he didn't have to report anymore.
That's a way to bring it up.
Yeah, so there's cool stuff like that. We're doing all kinds of cool stuff like that all over the place. It's a lot of fun.
Very nice. Now, and you found that these negotiation tactics, it doesn't matter where in the world you've traveled or where you're teaching folks, it's really all the same principles.
Every hostage negotiation team uses the same skills. The hostage negotiators in Tokyo, Japan, Cape Town, South Africa, Tel Aviv, Israel, Baghdad, Iraq, Colombia, Bogota, Colombia. Same 8 skills. Why is that? Because before we're a gender or before we're an ethnicity, we've got basic human wiring. And these eight skills are designed to bypass culture and go straight to what we are first, which is human beings. So yeah, this stuff works all over the planet.
And what are those eight skills, if you don't mind us asking?
Well, they're the R8 negotiation skills from the Black Swan Group, which is labels. As a hostage negotiator, I called questions, open-ended questions. We now refer to them as calibrated questions because they're calibrated for a certain effect. There's paraphrasing, there's summarizing, there's minimal encouragers. There's I messages, which are basically used to say no. You know, I'm sorry, I just can't do that. It's a form of an I message. There's something we call 3+, which is getting the person to say the answer three times in the same conversation. Because if it's a counterfeit yes, they're going to flinch on the second yes. No, nobody's used to giving yes more than once. So the second, you know, they're used to looking at you and saying yes the first time. And then if you say, all right, so you've agreed you're going to do this the second time, they'll go, yes, that's a big flinch. So there's a 3+. Let me see, what else have we got? Those are the main ones. I'm sure I missed a couple off the top of my head. They're all sort of grouped by usage. Oh, there's the mirroring, repeating the last 1 to 3 words of what somebody says. That's a Jedi mind trick. That's a lot of fun. So those are basically the skills.
Awesome. Awesome. Now, do you have, obviously your book, Never Split the Difference, is should be near the top of any negotiator's to read list, but do you have some other book recommendations?
You know, they're companion books. I like Eric Barker's book, Barking Up the Wrong Tree, a lot. It's about the science of success across the board. If it would have come out sooner, I would have been assigning it as assigned reading at Georgetown and at USC. It's that good. It's got that much useful stuff in it. Eric's book, Barking Up the Wrong Tree, is fantastic. I also like Stephen Kotler's book, The Rise of Superman, which is about the mindset of flow and the superpowers, which is why he calls it The Rise of Superman, that you can give yourself based on your own brain chemistry with an understanding of that chemistry and the endurance and the decision-making and the pattern recognition and the elimination of fear with the mind state of flow, what our traditional athletes we used to call being in the zone. You know, I've heard basketball players saying, like, when I'm in the zone, I can see the next 4 moves before any of them happen. I know in 3 seconds where the ball is going to appear, and so I fake, and then I run over there because I know the ball is going to be there. I mean, that's mental acuity. That's mental agility. And it helps in performance of any kind, whether you're playing basketball or whether you're negotiating.
Gotcha. Great, great list. I'll add those to the reading list here. Now, you have some programs and courses and books. And so where can someone start with everything that you do if they want to learn negotiation?
Thanks, man. The gateway to all of our stuff is actually our newsletter that comes out once a week called The Edge. And quickest, easiest way to subscribe to The Edge, which is complimentary. It's free. You know, I got an old friend that used to like to say, if it's free, I'll take 3. So you send a text, subscribe by text, send FBI empathy, all one word.
Okay.
Don't let your autocorrect put a space between FBI and empathy. Lowercase, send it to 22828. Send it to the number 22828. FBI empathy, all one word. You get a text message response. They'll sign you up for the newsletter. Newsletter comes out once a week, short, digestible stuff. You don't need to spend 20 minutes looking through it trying to figure out what you want. It's not information overload. And it's a great gateway to our website, which is blackswanltd.com. We got negotiation tools and advice, regardless of whether you're a company, whether you're an individual. The stuff in the newsletter, which has been coming out for a couple of years, is all free. And so you can browse through it and see if you find an article that suits your current situation at the moment, or it might point you to something else we have that can help.
And I will second that to say I've been going through your website and reading some of the blog posts. It's very well organized. So going through, you can find pretty much exactly what it is that you're looking for.
Thanks.
Now, do you have a favorite type of negotiation? Now that you've moved outside of, you know, the hostage world and more into the business world, is there a specific type of negotiation that you like more than another?
You know, to me, like they're all so fascinating because, you know, there's hidden information in every one. You know, I coached a woman through, she's trying to make a couple of small movies here in town. And she's trying to make one. And with the deal that I helped her coach, she ended up with two films. She's a producer. You know, sales is great. We did a one-day training session in New York City last week. One of the people that showed up for sales with this one tactic we gave him broke his company's sales record.
Wow.
So it's crazy. I mean, it's all so much fun because it's all human interaction. I mean, I enjoy it all.
Gotcha. Now, a few questions just about you, some fun ones to wrap everything up here. If you could have a conversation with anyone, past, present, future, fact or fiction, who would it be?
Jesus, Einstein, and Mark Cuban.
Now, that'd be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, you know, the planet's great religious leaders, whether you're atheist or not, and I'm not, you know, I'm a Christian, but I mean, they were also brilliant with emotional intelligence. Otherwise, they wouldn't have become a great religious leader. So, you know, sometimes I'm like, all right, so I get what you were thinking here religiously, but operationally, practically, this was designed for the human being as an animal, right? And want to get that answer out of Jesus, you know. You sit down, you know, he had a glass of wine at the Last Supper, so maybe you could sit down with Jesus over a glass of wine and have a heart-to-heart talk. You know, Einstein, crazy rascal, you know, playful, silly, had fun. You know, Einstein graduated last in his class in college. Not because he was stupid, but because he was irreverent. You know, I figure that guy got a great sense of humor. You know, he would have been fun to talk to. And his crazy view of the world where, you know, every scientist that looks at Einstein talks about his thought experiments. You know, Einstein figured this stuff out. What's a thought experiment? That's a guy up in his head thinking crazy things. You know, he used to think about what's it like to ride a bicycle along a light beam. I mean, just a wacky, to me, like, out sounds there. Like a fun guy out there. You know, and Mark Cuban, Cuban's having a ball.
Yeah.
He's doing crazy, wacky stuff. I watch him on Shark Tank. I think he's far more playful than people take him to be. And we've got a partnership now. My company has a partnership with Node, which is a company, an artificial intelligence rising star startup company headed by this brilliant young lady named Fallon Fatemi, CEO of the future. Young, happening, smart, feminine woman. And Cuban is one of her main backers. And she talks about hanging out with Cuban and just talking to him like a human being. And that, you know, she describes a smart, playful guy. And if I didn't know her, she'd probably be on my list of people that I'd want to sit down and talk to also because she's brilliant.
Fair
enough. So, you know, those are my three choices.
That would be a good one. Now, I forgot to ask earlier. So what projects are you currently working on or what's upcoming in the Black Swan Group?
Well, we're working with Node, which is an artificial intelligence company, and Fallon as CEO is like, let's marry artificial intelligence with emotional intelligence, and let's see what kind of crazy stuff we can come up with. So we're developing mostly training for sales and marketing, C-suite executives, top flight people with a lot at stake, and just hearing her ideas on blending our stuff into their stuff just blows me away.
That's going to be some fascinating information once that merges together.
Yeah, it's very cool. And then, you know, we're doing stuff with sales and marketing. And, you know, people talk about millennials these days. Old folks like me like to badmouth the millennials, which is silly because they're bringing a new way of thinking to us that we need to blend into. A millennial that I ran into in Boston just a couple of weeks ago with his company. Took his job is to get prospective clients on a phone and get a meeting. Before he blended our stuff into what he was doing, he was getting meetings 3% of the time. Now he's getting them 85% of the time.
Wow.
He's blowing salespeople away with the application of our emotional intelligence into traditional sales. That excites me. So we're blending that stuff into sales. I mean, real estate. We got a bunch of real estate projects going. We got stuff going all over the place. It's a lot of fun.
You got all sorts going on there.
Yeah.
Now, second to last question. I know that you are an inspiration to many. You've touched thousands of lives in what you do, but who do you look to as an inspiration?
Wow. Wow. There's like a long list. All right. So, I got to tell you something. I'm inspired by Fallon, the CEO of Node.
Mm-hmm.
She just, and to me, she represents the next generation and of American CEOs, which are effectively international CEOs. Are women. What women are bringing to the table these days are advancing the entire planet. So, I'm inspired by her ability to adapt and be smart and still be true to herself. I mean, she's still very true to herself, which is a struggle for anybody. You know, I'm inspired by Cuban stuff. He's having fun. You know, he reads all the time. He talks about, if I don't stay on the cutting edge, some 12-year-old is going to beat me. But he's clearly having a lot of fun with it. I get a kick out of that. Those are just two people off the top of my head.
Awesome. Now, final question. Is there anything that you wish I had asked that we haven't talked about, or do you have any final words of wisdom?
Wow. No. Only that, this emotional intelligence thing that is all that hostage negotiators are doing. We got weapons grade emotional intelligence. It'll work for everybody. I mean, it just takes just a little bit of a willingness to take a chance. You know, everybody's risk taking is the different levels. You know, try it out. Do it in high stakes conversations. Try some of this crazy Jedi mind stuff that we talk about in the book. Read the first 5 pages of the book. I promise you, you'll be hooked. And try it out. And like, the other side doesn't have to lose for it to be a great negotiation. That's the other thing too. This is not, I win, you lose. You know, this is more like, let's find something cool here that we can work on. And take an approach like that in negotiation, you'll have a ball and you'll have more friends too.
Fantastic. Thank you again, Chris. You have given us some awesome insight, lots of information. I've got about 3 pages of notes here to put together a description. We'll make sure to put links to your newsletter down on the bottom, all of your books, of course, your programs. Once again, I thank you for joining us here today.
Yeah, man. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And that's a wrap. What did you think? Let us know your favorite tip that you learned in the comments below. If you know someone who could use a little bit of inspiration and needs to work in their negotiation skills, go ahead and send them this link. Remember, sharing is caring. I've also included links to Chris's website, his newest book, and all of his programs. So if there's something that we talked about and you want to find out a little bit more about it, I've made it super easy. All that information is in the description box below. As always, click subscribe right down there in the corner so you never miss a video, and turn on your alerts so you'll get notified every time we upload a new video. Don't forget, every Wednesday, just like this, we'll have more expert interviews so you can learn the very best tips right from the source. Mondays are life lessons from TV shows, and Fridays we've got difficult behaviors and personality breakdowns. So a little bit of something for everyone. Finally, last but not least, don't miss open enrollment on our brand new course, Millennial Magnetism. Click the link in the description box below, and we will show you how you can unleash your inner awesome in only 10 minutes a day. Until next time, ciao for now.